This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Hubert's Dime Museum and Flea Circus is a long-gone Times Square freak show. In the late 50s and early 60s, photographer Diane Arbus was a frequent visitor. A few years ago, a cache of lost photos that Arbus made of the life of Hubert's in its final years surfaced. On the program today, we'll talk about Hubert's, Arbus, and the man who brought the photos to light. Our guest is Gregory Gibson. He is the author of Hubert's Freaks, The Rare Book Dealer, The Times Square Talker, and The Lost Photos of Diane Arbus. Our guest, Gregory Gibson, is a writer and antiquarian book dealer. In addition to Hubert's Freaks, he is the author of Gone Boy, A Walkabout, and Demon of the Waters, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Whale Ship Globe. His new book, Hubert's Freaks, The Rare Book Dealer, The Times Square Talker, and The Lost Photos of Diane Arbus, is published by Harcourt. Gregory Gibson, it's so good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
Hubert's opened back in 1926. What was it like in the 20s?
Very different than it is now. Times Square had been a flourishing theater district. It still was in the 20s, but it was on its way downhill, and it descended rapidly through the 30s, 40s, and 50s until it got to be what was widely regarded as the worst neighborhood in Manhattan. Drug addicts, perverts, outlaws of all kinds frequented it. And this was the venue, the ambiance for Hubert's Dime Museum.
Yeah. Now tell us about the history of the building there on West 42nd Street and what's there now.
Well, it has a distinguished lineage, or the building had a distinguished lineage. It was designed by the famous architectural firm of McKim, Mead, and White, originally as a schoolhouse, but then was taken over by a restaurateur who reconfigured it as one of the first theme restaurants in Manhattan. It was called Murray's Roman Gardens, and it was done up as an opulent Roman villa. It must have been quite a place to eat. Diamond Jim Brady ate there, as did many of the other bon vivants of their day. But it was torn down in the course of what some refer to as the Disneyfication of Times Square, and is now replaced by Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, which, although it's a very different building, is probably an apt substitute for for a freak show.
Yeah. Now, in the 50s and 60s, what was Hubert's like? Who and what were the star attractions then?
Well, it was a freak show, a sideshow, and as such, it was a dying institution. These things had been fairly common all through America. They accompanied circuses and carnivals around the country. But by the 60s, they were on their way out as a form of entertainment. They featured people with physical deformities and people who feigned physical deformity or what we now know as performance art, sticking pins through their cheeks, so forth and so on, as well as sort of canned static exhibits of marvelous wonders. It was an entertainment of a different day and age. It was funky. It was wonderful. It was, by the 60s, it came with its own kind of nostalgia because it was clear it was on the way out. So the people who went there in the 50s and 60s, and I've spoken to a great many of them, did so, I think, with a kind of wonder and a kind of delight that they were getting to see perhaps the last sort of this kind of entertainment.
Yeah. Now, do any of the people who were the stars of Hubert's survive, and were you able to talk with them?
A few. Most of them have died over the years, but two or three of them were located by Bob, the protagonist of my story, and I have spoken with them. They have very vivid memories of their days in Hubert's Dime Museum and of Times Square. Interestingly, they didn't seem to regard it as a dicey place at all. It was just where they went to work. I guess they were, you know, they were used to it. They were relaxed
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah. What were the lives of those folks like back in the day?
They were hard. They had to work hard. The economics were slim, meager. But they had no sense that they were freaks. They regarded themselves as performers, you know, physically different perhaps than the norm, but still they were utilizing their physical difference as best they could to make a living. There was a kind of dignity to it that I think might surprise us in this age of political correctness. They were proud of their deformities in many cases and relied on them to, you know, as a means of livelihood.
Yeah. And what did they do when Hubert's was no more, than when there were no more live acts?
Well, there were still a few circulating, traveling carnivals and sideshows. There was a little bit of action in Coney Island, but I think by that time most of them just went into retirement. It was kind of a sad passing. And I should mention that in the 60s, what replaced Hubert's in Times Square, in a way, what drove this kind of entertainment out was the burgeoning porno industry, you know, with the advent of videos and the easier way of showing films. There got to be more and more of this kind of stuff, as well as live, so-called live entertainment. And people were more interested in seeing that than they were seeing freaks.
Do you think we might see something like Hubert's reemerge?
Well, in a way it has, but it's reemerged as a different, a more self-conscious kind of theater. You know, we've got a very different attitude now toward physical deformity, and we've got a very different attitude toward alterity, toward difference. In 1960, to see a man with a bone in his ear or covered with tattoos was a really scary and unusual sight. Today, you know, it's fairly commonplace. So the whole atmosphere for this kind of entertainment has changed. But there are performers who want to keep the tradition alive, who recognize it was a vital American tradition at one time. And there are still a couple of venues at Coney Island where they do this sort of thing.
What's Coney Island's future at this point?
Gee, I don't know. I imagine in some way, as long as the real estate situation is viable there, these little islands of entertainment will survive.
Yeah. One wonders, though, if it might not be Disneyfied like Times Square has been.
Yeah, or condoized.
Condoized.
You know, it's waterfront.
Yeah.
So, yeah, its fate is certainly uncertain in that way, isn't it?
Well, we certainly have seen a lot of neighborhoods in New York change, haven't we?
For sure. Yeah, it's all about change.
Yeah. Well, when and how did Hubert's come to the attention of Diane Arbus?
In the 50s, she was led there perhaps by her teacher, Lisette Modell, or some of her sort of beatnik friends. Hubert's was a very popular form of entertainment back then in a kind of a postmodernist, goofy way. Intellectuals went to goof on it. They enjoyed the nostalgia. They enjoyed the charm. Of course, it was right up Arbus's alley because of the performers. They were, you know, they were freaks. And prior to this, I don't think she had established her identity as a photographer of freaks. After her contact with Hubert's, that became a part of what she was known for.
Yeah. Now, as you point out in Hubert's Freaks, photographs were forbidden and guests were not allowed in dressing rooms. So here we have another important figure in this story enter, Charlie Lucas.
Yeah. The black man who ran Hubert's Museum, he was also a compulsive gambler and used dreams to predict the numbers of the numbers game that he played, usually without success, but that resulted in him leaving behind several volumes of his dream journals, which are just amazing. The dream journals of an African-American sideshow talker in New York in the 1950s and 60s are perhaps as significant and unusual as the photographs of Arbus.
Yeah. Have these dream journals and the other things that were found, discovered long after Hubert's closed its doors, have these been treated with some respect? You mentioned earlier Bob, who is Bob Langmuir.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about him a little bit. Yeah. And these things are very important to him.
Yes.
They have been. So the dream journals and the other materials, what's happened to them?
Well, in the first place, in the first part of a long process, someone has to identify them, say what they are, explain where they fit in their culture, and prove to us that they are as important as they should be. And this was Bob's mission, really, and something that consumed him over the course of 3 or 4 years. Ultimately, he was successful in doing this to the degree that they attracted the attention of the art world. The Metropolitan Museum was interested in acquiring them. Several auction houses expressed interest. And finally, he signed a deal with an auction house named Phillips DePuy in Manhattan. They were scheduled to be auctioned last Tuesday, and then in an amazing further chapter to this saga, the auction was canceled.
Right, and the website for the auction house says private sale is pending.
Yeah, well...
And there's a lawsuit as well.
Yeah, the one of the people from whom Bob acquired some of the material claimed that he had a prior arrangement with Bob for sharing the profits. However, I think his case is hampered by the fact that no contract or written agreement to this so-called arrangement exists. So we'll see how that all irons out. Needless to say, when one makes a discovery of this kind, and in a way that's the bottom line of the book, the real inside story of the book is what happens when you make the discovery of your dreams. Everybody fantasizes about finding the chest full of gold, but you know, in the old fairy tales, the chest, the gift often comes with a curse, and I think that's the way it's playing out for Bob in a most unusual way.
How has all of this changed him, or has it?
It certainly has. I mean, he's had to, just to survive the rigors of this, you can imagine what a roller coaster the whole thing is, and if you're a certain type of personality, a certain very sensitive kind of individual, you are rocked and socked by these ups and downs. He's had a really rough time of it, and I think probably in the long result, it's made him a stronger, better person, and perhaps the book documents that. I don't know.
Yeah. I have a feeling that through all of this, he's come through some awfully difficult times,
yeah.
But he seemed like he's landed right side up.
I think he's really found a kind of inner peace through all of this. Perhaps, you know, he had a deep, deep association with Arbus and with Charlie Lucas. Even though they were both long dead, he felt as if they were his soulmates, his kin. And I think it's possible to say that he learned a great deal from these two people, from what they left behind them, even though they were dead, and benefited from what he learned from these two very diverse but equally interesting characters.
What did he learn?
Well, I think in the final instance, what he learned was that life is about more than acquiring goods. In other words, when you get this chest and it appears to be all treasure, all gold, perhaps that's not the real treasure. I think he learned from these people what really is important in life. And, you know, Arbus was a great genius. He was a great artist. And in a way, that's the point of art, isn't it? To have us reexamine our values, to have us look around and think about what's really important in life. And I think just by contact with this great artist's work, ultimately Bob had to do that. And it was a tough process, but I think he persevered.
Yeah. Back to Charlie Lucas, can you give us some sense of what's in the dream journals?
Wow, they're surreal. They're surreal. In the black community at that time, there were published books that would give numeric correspondence for various themes in a dream. So if you dreamt about cats, it might be a 9. If you dreamt about a white woman, it would be a 6. If you dreamt about a man and a woman, it would be a 31, that sort of thing. So it's a very, in a way, meticulous recording of these elements of his dreams. And then, you know, in the next paragraph, he'd say, so Well, he'd say, so he'd record the dream and then say, so the number was 931, and in the next paragraph he might say, well, the number came in 582. He hardly ever made it. But in the course of accumulating this kind of information, all interspersed with his daily activities in this freak show that was in the basement of an amusement parlor on Times Square, the characters who came in and out, the conflicts he had with other performers, his friendships with other performers, all this is mixed in with his dream life, and it has a most fascinatingly surreal aspect to it, and, but also very informative of the minutia of how people like him lived back then.
Yeah. Well, Charlie Lucas is the Times Square talker of the subtitle.
Yes.
Hubert's Freaks, the rare book dealer, the Times Square talker, and the lost photos of Diane Arbus. Do you have a sense of, through looking through these materials that that Charlie Lucas left, what his shtick would have been like as a talker?
Well, one of the most interesting documents he left behind was not of the written kind. It was actually a reel-to-reel tape that he recorded in 1965. The term for that they used was a grind tape, and it was to be played over and over again in an eternal loop upstairs in the arcade with the purpose, the intent of luring people downstairs into the freak show. So we get to actually hear this guy, and because he's got to talk for an hour, he's riffing, he's improvising, and some of the stuff that he comes up with is really pretty incredible. It's almost like a jazz speech performance. A wonderful document. I'm going to try to get it up on my website, hubertfreaks.com, so that people can actually listen to this thing. It's just an incredible oral document.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we will make a link at our website as well to hubertsfreaks.com. I look forward to seeing that. At the Auction House website, you can see the photos, albeit, you know, it's not exactly great to look at a photo online. But
no, but it gives you an idea of the kind of material that Bob discovered. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, What kind of thing would Charlie Lucas say to lure us down into Hubert's to see the act from the arcade?
Well, he'd begin with a straightforward description of the hours and all the worldly pleasures that the place afforded. He had a soft drink machine and they weren't called toilets or men's rooms and ladies' rooms. There was a ladies' powder room and a men's smoking room, and of course, this is just shabby.
Yeah.
Basement stuff, but in his talker inflated rhetoric, it becomes some kind of gentlemanly, Nick and Nora Roberts kind of gentlemanly existence. And then in the middle of this start getting dropped snakes and sexual innuendos and all kinds of juicy stuff to really make you curious about these. He talk about girls who dance the way you like to see them dance. That sort of thing, and of course, it was just old, tired old waitresses on their off shift who were picking up a couple of extra bucks. But to hear Charlie described it sounded like an exotic Far Eastern harem or something like this. You know?
Yeah.
Just wonderful, overinflated, but really imaginative, colorful stuff.
Yeah.
A kind of talk, I should add, that really doesn't exist anymore. You know, I mean, all the pitchmen on TV are much more sophisticated than this now.
Yeah. I remember years ago, though, seeing a pitchman at a state fair who was really good.
That's about the closest it gets in terms of survival. The state fairs, the local sort of things that still go around, they're barely hanging on, but that would be the closest, yeah.
Yeah, and he was peddling something like a Popeil kind of a thing, a Ron Popeil kind of a thing. But
yeah.
he was really good, and he was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I think there's real energy. And I think even then, people, as much as they were or were were not convinced by it, there was really an entertainment value in this guy's speech. And he knew it, and his audience knew it as well.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Gregory Gibson, author most recently of Hubert's Freaks, The Rare Book Dealer, The Times Square Talker, and The Lost Photos of Diane Arbus. Hubert's Dime Museum and Flea Circus is a long-gone Times Square freak show. In the late 50s and 60s, photographer Diane Arbus was a frequent visitor, and a few years ago, a cache of lost photographs that Arbus made of the life of Hubert's in its final years surfaced, and it fell into the hands of Bob Langmuir. He is the rare book dealer, and of course, we've been talking about the Times Square talker, who is Charlie Lucas. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So how did Charlie Lucas come to be part of this world?
Well, he started out as a circus or sideshow performer himself. He was a There was a whole tradition of African Americans posing as wild African savages. And in the beginning, it was a straight hoax. They really posed as wild men, but gradually it morphed into a kind of entertainment shtick, almost a blackface, a vaudevillian sort of thing. So early in his career, Charlie was one of these guys. He walked beds of hot coals and climbed saw blade ladders. His wife, Wooji, was a snake charmer, but she was a very attractive woman, and he was a very attractive man, and they did a routine called, a pseudo-African routine called the Dance of Love,
yeah.
Which must have really been a sizzling number calculated to play on the fantasies that people had about smoldering African passion. The whole thing was kind of an overhyped shtick, but a lot of fun, I suspect.
Yeah. There's a photo, one of the wonderful photos in the book. There's a photo of him in Chicago in 33 at the Century of Progress, where
right.
He's billed as Prince Wu Fu,
yeah.
The Immune Man.
Yeah, that was his big break.
Yeah, and here we have he's on a bed of nails, and there's a ladder of saw blades behind him. How did they do that? Did they really do that? I mean, was that stuff sharp?
I don't know. I think there's a term that the sideshow people use gaffed. That means it's an illusion. It's not really what it appears to be. And probably the whole thing was gaffed. I mean, he was just a regular fellow like you and I. There might have been some trick in the way you stand on these things, or perhaps they were designed so that there were so many nails that the combined pressure of the foot on all the nails wasn't insupportable. I don't really know how they did it, but, you know, although he was a talented talker, I don't think he had superhuman foot powers. I think it was just basically a sideshow trick.
Yeah.
I like the detail that you can see in the photograph. It all folded into one suitcase, and you can see it kind of spread out on the photograph. But it was clear, you know, he could pack this thing up and take it with him wherever he went.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the flea circus. I'm, you know, way too young to know a flea circus, but your book inspired me to get curious, and now I went online, and YouTube has got flea circuses.
Do they really?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
So that was a real deal, though, this flea circus.
Oh, for sure, yeah. People would come from far and wide. It was a separate admission within the freak show to go see Heckler's flea circus. My favorite detail about the thing was one time Roy Heckler, the flea maestro, divulged how he selected and trained his fleas. Apparently, there was a certain kind of dog flea that he preferred above all others as being more trainable. But he'd get these fleas and he'd put them in a test tube, and as soon as the fleas were confined, they'd start hopping up and down, and you know, they'd bang their heads on the top of the test tube because he'd lay the tube sideways. And the fleas that stopped hopping first, he figured, were the smartest ones, the most trainable ones. So he'd pick them out of the test tube with the tweezers and put the rest of the guys back on the dog and let them go. training fleas.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I've always been pretty respectful of fleas. I mean, they really know their business, but...
Very highly specialized.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of a performance, occasionally, it would be feeding time, and Professor Heckler would amuse his audience by letting them watch as he inverted a tumbler full of fleas on his forearm and let them let them chow down while he smoked a cigar.
Yuck.
Yeah, there was sort of a gamey aspect to this whole flea circus freak show thing that is certainly part of its attraction and revulsion simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, back to Charlie and Woojie Lucas. This was surprising to learn. It wasn't unusual for African Americans to belong to sideshows.
Well, it was at the time of the Century of Progress. It was, you know, we were still in the grips of the Depression. There was a lot of unemployment, and this was, sure, the entertainment world was a viable place for African Americans to find work, the venues they might not otherwise have been exposed to. Yes, it involved the African savage shtick, but there again, you know, the way we measure things now are perhaps by different standards than the way things were measured back then. It was, you know, it was entertainment, it was a job, it was a living, and they did it.
Yeah. Have many scholars of African American history looked into this?
Yeah, there have been a couple of books recently taking this theme up. So it's, you know, it's a, I think it's something that people are becoming aware of as African American studies become more detailed and deeper.
Yeah, that leads me to ask this question, which is an obvious one. But how did you come across this story, and when did you realize it had so many fascinating components?
Well, I'm an antiquarian bookseller too, and I was at a show about 4 years ago, and this character that I had known for 20 years, but who had dropped out of sight in recent years, showed up, and he was on fire. He was always a great raconteur, but this night, he entertained me for hours by telling me this mad story about a Times Square freak show and a mysterious Nigerian prince and people with strange deformities and Diane Arbus and all this kind of stuff. And I just fell in love with the story. I said, geez, this would make a great book. Mm-hmm. And happily, the way it worked out, we sort of established a mutual trust and collaboration, probably based on the years we'd known each other. And he was he gave me complete access to his life, to his thinking process. I get to watch him make these discoveries and analyze them and try to figure out what they were.
How does Bob Langmuir feel about the book?
I think he's happy with it. I think he finds it accurate. And I think he hopes it sells a lot of copies. He doesn't have a financial interest in it in that way, but I think he thinks it would really enhance the fate of the Arbus archive, especially now that it's kind of undetermined. The book is kind of his plea for the archive, or his voice for the discovery of the archive.
Yeah. Well, if a private sale is indeed pending, I hope it falls into good hands, or comes into good hands.
Yeah, we're all hoping for the best. It's unclear to me. I called them the morning they announced the cancellation and asked them if it was their intention to keep the material together. Why had they offered it initially in individual lots? They were unable to answer that question. I don't know. I hope that the private buyer comes through and the archive is preserved intact.
Yeah. Did they say that they had combined the lots?
No, they said they were sorry. They were unable to say anything about it.
Say anything about
so
it.
We're obviously, there's some process going on there that that'll have to reach completion before we know the ultimate fate of the archive.
Perhaps some negotiations are still underway.
I would guess there would be some pretty intense negotiations going on right now, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now to Diane Arbus, we've only kind of touched on her part of the story here. It was through Charlie Lucas and his wife, Woojie, that Arbus really gained entrance into this world. They became friends. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, he was her guide and collaborator, I suppose, and showed her the way into this strange subculture of sideshow performers and freaks. It's probably more revealed in the photographs that she took of these people, and especially of him, what her relationship was. Of course, nothing was written down, nothing was recorded, but there's a certain relaxation, there's a certain trust, there's a certain very evident acceptance of the camera, of Arvis, that leads us to believe she used all her considerable personal skills to engage these people as equals, to get them to trust her, to get them to open up to her. And indeed, some of the tips that Charlie gave her led her on to new venues, new places to photograph, and some of the people that she met at Hubert's became years later the subjects of some of her most famous photographs. The giant at home with his parents, she met him first at Hubert's and then followed him for almost a decade until that absolutely perfect moment when he was in his apartment dwarfing his mother and father, and that became one of her most famous images. But if it hadn't have been for Hubert's, it probably never would have happened.
Why was she drawn to this world and to other places where, I don't know how to put this exactly, but where things were kind of really unusual? How about that?
Yeah, it's tough to say. So much has been written and so much has been just baloney. You know, you almost don't want to go there in that world of analysis, but
yeah.
It's pretty obvious that her photographs challenge us in a very particular way, with questions about what normalcy is, what alterity is, what's beautiful, what's ugly. In a way, it stands everything on its head. In a way, the most freakish people can seem to be the most normal people. So I think probably her choice of these people as subjects had to do with her exploration of this kind of question. And, you know, the way she photographed them really was very conventional. It was just straight-on portraiture with the rectitude and dignity and everything else a good, honest portrait implies. So it wasn't that she was taking wacky photographs of these people. She was just choosing different people than had ever been formally photographed, transvestites, transgender people. Deformed people. That's what she's noted for the most, but in fact, the majority of the pictures in her canon of her greatest pictures are of normal people, but they still carry this weight of difference, of strangeness.
Yeah. Well, she had been a fashion photographer, and she photographed many celebrities, and then, of course, her work in places like Hubert's. I wonder what kind of working relationships she had with the people she photographed. You hinted at this, that she charmed the people at Hubert's. I wonder what she was, what it was like to sit for her or to allow her to photograph you.
Well, there are stories in the Arvis canon about her confrontations with some of her subjects. I didn't get any of that. I did find one of the ex-freaks, Jack Dracula, subject of one of her famous photographs, The Marked Man, and he had quite a bit to say about her, about his interaction with her, and he made it sound as if she wasn't really a very interesting person to him. He sort of he felt like he tolerated her and let her take these pictures, but that she really wasn't. We all think of her as a genius. He just thought she was I forget the phrase he used, an odd duck or something like that.
Mm.
So we do have a little evidence of how she engaged him, but that's about all I could dig up as far as her working methods went.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't long after this influential show opened up new documents at the Museum of Modern Art that she was a celebrity. How did she feel about her celebrity?
I think it was very difficult for her. She was it's that theme of the gift and the curse. She was a gifted, brilliant photographer, but she was cursed with depressive episodes and a kind of lethargy, self-questioning. Again, you don't want to go too far into the psychology of a great artist, because the art speaks for itself and is integral. But we know she had tremendous personal difficulties, and I think that that was part of her process. The fame that came to her was welcome for a minute, and then a great burden to her. I think she got to a point where she felt people were copying her, where people wanted too much of her time, and all this was very stressful to her. She just wanted to go off and take pictures, work on her stuff.
Yeah. Well, that celebrity actually physically got in the way of her working.
Absolutely, yeah. Once she got known for what she did, editors were reluctant to hire her for certain kinds of work, because Norman Mailer said something like, giving a camera to Diane Arbus is like giving a loaded gun to a baby. So you can imagine there would be a certain kind of egotistical celebrity that would be very reluctant to get in front of Arbus's camera.
Yeah. That show at the Museum of Modern Art in 1967, New Documents, was really influential. And here we begin to see the upward spiral of photography as being seen as art. And her work in particular, and the work of others. And I thought it was interesting to learn in Hubert's Freaks that she invited the Lucases to the show.
Yeah, you know, when you ask that question about what her relationship with them was, doesn't that really tell you a lot? Here she is, she's sending out invitations to people like Leonard Bernstein. I actually saw this piece of paper, and three lines after it, she invites Charlie Lucas and Wooji, and she writes in the margin, "She is a snake charmer," and obviously she's thrilled to know these kinds of people as she is to know the Bernsteins. It's kind of a lovely thing that speaks for itself about her and about her whole approach to what she did.
Yeah. Back to Bob Langmuir, if we might now. Tell us a little bit about what led him to become a collector, and it's very interesting to think about what it is that he finds so rewarding in collecting.
Well, we speak about Arbus as having a gift, but it's also true, I think, that Bob had a gift of his own. He was blessed with an ability to see things in a way that the rest of us don't. He could see visually the possibility in this material, not just the Arbus photographs, but all the kinds of stuff that he collects, the ephemera. A great deal of it is visual, and that's part of his gift, part of his nature, part of who he is. And ultimately, over the course of his life, I think he was able to make a living on his own visual abilities.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Gregory Gibson. He's a writer and antiquarian book dealer. He is the author, most recently, of Hubert's Freaks, The Rare Book Dealer, The Times Square Talker, and The Lost Photos of Diane Arbus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to give us a call and join us with a question or a comment, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Langmuir calls the 1970s, the early 1970s, that recession of the period, a golden age, because people were casting about looking for things that they could sell to make a little money, to make ends meet. Do interesting things turn up in times of recession as people cast about for a little extra money?
I think you could make that generalization, but in the 70s particularly, it was the sort of the birth of collectibles as we now think of them. I don't think people had really gone into their attics before with the knowledge and awareness that they brought in the 1970s. So some tremendous stuff started coming out, and the end result of that is the roadshow and eBay and all this.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're very Now we're very hip to all this kind of stuff. And it all started, I think, in the 70s when people started bringing down the stuff that their parents had, bringing out the stuff that their parents had, and finding to their amazement that there was a ready market for it among collectors. It was partly that they were driven, I suppose, by the recession, by the tightness of money, but it was something bigger than that. It was kind of a cultural looking back on itself and saying, hey, maybe this junk is good for something.
And it's always fun to see those folks on Antiques Roadshow go, oh my God, I had no idea.
Yeah, that's the...
Some of this stuff doesn't look like much.
That's the basic visceral charge, yeah. I think, that keeps Bob going and in a way that informs this story. And there again, you know, it's a gift, it's a blessing, but it might come with its own curse.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the upward spiral in prices paid for Arbus's work from the time of her suicide in 1971 to today. And then maybe you could talk a little bit here about, you know, given all the money involved, you know, one can guess that the marketplace might be just shark infested.
Well, it's a pretty remarkable story that relates in a way to this whole, you know, people going into their attic in the 70s. Back then, or when Arbus was alive in the late 60s, she was getting about $150 a piece for her photographs when she could sell them. There was no great market for them. And then in the 80s and 90s, that market just accelerated. I mean, we all think it's remarkable how the stock market exploded. The world of photography probably accelerated at a rate two or three times that of the stock market, so that this photograph, say, of the twins that Arbus might have had difficulty selling for $150 in 2004 sells for $500,000. Single photograph, just a sheet of photographic paper, $500,000. Last week in Sotheby's in New York, another one of her iconic images sold again for over $500,000. So this escalation in values of photographs as collectible items, as art items, has just been one of the remarkable stories of the end of the 20th century in the art world. Of course, they're undervalued compared to paintings, which routinely bring in the millions, but when you think where they've come from, their growth has been nothing short of remarkable.
Yeah. Have you given any thought to, I'm sure you have, what kind of thought have you given to the question of how we assign value to a piece of art?
Boy, I've given a lot of thought to it, and I know that Bob has. There was one interesting instance when he was having the Arbus photographs authenticated by the Arbus estate, in which there were two photographs taken in the same location, obviously minutes apart. One was authenticated by the estate and hence worth tens of thousands of dollars at least. The other one, for whatever reason at that time, they could not find the negative that corresponded to it and they did not authenticate it. Who knows what it did sell for? $500 maybe. It was just an interesting old photograph. Now, they're almost identical photographs. They're almost identical in terms of their imagery, in terms of their artistry, in terms of their quality. Manifestly, they were taken in the same time, in the same place, by the same person, and yet the authentication of the estate causes the first object to have this enormous value compared to the unauthenticated object. And you just... That story is like a conundrum to me, a Zen riddle. I play it over and over again to myself, and I still wonder what does that mean? And yet, you know, the art world just accepts it without question. If it's an authenticated Arbus photo, it will have a certain value. If it's not, it doesn't.
How do I buy an unauthenticated Diane Arbus?
Well, you can go to go to eBay and take your chances, I guess.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Okay.
Gregory Gibson, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Gregory Gibson is the author of Hubert's Freaks, The Rare Book Dealer, The Times Square Talker, and The Lost Photos of Diane Arbus. The book is published by Harcourt.